Welcome to Sustainable Sessions, hosted by yours truly, Lucas and Lauren. Episode 23, featuring Denise Grafton.
Okay, my name is Denise Grafton. I live in lovely London, Ontario, which is probably not as lovely as the other London, but it'll do. And I work full-time actually at St. Joseph's Hospital, which is in London, Ontario. I work in quality measurement, which is sort of a decision support department, but my background is I'm a Laurier grad, but I did my degree in geography and liked it so much I did a master's, and then I also did a PhD. So since I have all this wonderful invested education, I've been teaching part-time, so I'm a full-time sort of person, but for my hobby I teach online at Laurier and I teach in person in health studies and geography at Western.
Nice.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. obviously we're diving in a little bit more on climate change, like of all the different concepts of climate change from like composting to plastic pollution and everything in between, like which topics are you most interested in? Obviously it's probably pretty broad, but is there anything that you have a big interest in?
I have always found it interesting, more or less, I think it's the geography part is perception studies. So I'm more small scale. So why is it that people don't think climate change is real? What's the psychology behind that? I find it interesting to the sort of anti-climate change movement. I do a lot of reading in that just because when I was doing my master's, I had a professor, shout out to Graham Smith, who makes you think about things that you wouldn't normally do and basically is the devil's advocate in a lot of things. So a lot of the work he gave me was sort of kind of the antithesis of what I actually believed. And I think it's really good to read stuff like that. Like something like a Bjorn Lomborg book, he has a new one this year. And although he makes me crazy when I read it, I think it helps me as an educator to understand where they're coming from. And they have such a wide audience and the man uses science, right? Like it's just really interesting to sort of get that perspective because you often deal with students who don't believe or believe this. So it's good to know both sides. So I kind of like that psychology part of it, the perception studies and why people think what they think. But I don't actively study it.
Was there anything from like those books that you read that you took kind of into consideration? You're like, oh my gosh, I would have never thought.
Yeah, like I'm actually pretty interested on that topic as well too. And even like both of us, even with this podcast and like a lot of the content that we put out is like, we like to talk about stuff like this because we're always trying to like expand our audience and get more people on board. So it's like, it's interesting to know like
what's the reason for why people have these conclusions.
No, for sure. My daughter actually got a book and what was it called? I wrote it down. Don't even think about it. Why our brains are wired to ignore climate science, which I haven't read yet, but I've stolen it from her. And that's interesting because a lot of geography is perception and about environmental perception. So climate's really just part of that. But Bjorn Lomborg, he's always kind of been, you know, a troublemaker, but just sort of the things where they use old historical data to sort of show you a pattern of recurring warming and what had happened. And, you know, obviously I believe in the IPCC report, but it's interesting to see that. And then there's a really neat book that Brian Fagan wrote called The Great Warming, which is a historical study of like the 10th and 15th century when they had a warming and what it was like and how civilizations collapsed. So it was good because it showed you what Lomborg did, but it also showed you sort of the negative side where he tends to focus on like rah-rah science will save us and that kind of thing, which I also find interesting too, because you'll probably remember from geography class, I'm a big fan of Paul Ehrlich, and there was that book, The Population Bomb, which then turned into a CBC documentary where he had a big debate with Julian Simon. And it's interesting to have one scientist say, this is what I predict, but then the technocentric side actually catches up. And, you know, it's funny because you could just see this year, 2020, that, yeah, you could make a difference really quick if you had to, right? So,
yeah. That's really interesting, too, because even on the topic of, like, all the innovation that's going to be required for us to, like, quote, unquote, like, escape all the immediate threats of climate change. So like that's, you know, discovering renewable energy, solving a solution for like plastic, microplastic, there's infinite different categories that we're going to have like really incredible innovation to even say that we've like beaten it. So it's kind of like, what is our objective here? Are we trying to get to a point where we have perfection, total sustainability, let's say, or are we just trying to like avoid increasing, like we just want to get a lot better, but not necessarily reach perfection. I think there's like so many different perspectives where some people have like, you want to go all the way to the end. Some people are like, you know, let's just get here. Some people are like, let's just not do what we're doing now. And there's like all these different, like you said, perceptions on what the problem really is and what we'll need to do to solve it.
Because really when it comes down to it, it's a people problem, right? Like that's really what it is. And so I think you can't just have one discipline solve that problem, which is why I think the IPCC report is interesting, because it's got scientists from every nook and cranny of the, you know, professional universe. And I think that's really important.
One thing that I want to bring up, just because I remember from your class so vividly, the one report that I did on carbon taxes and like carbon solutions, maybe, I don't know if you want to kind of touch on your thoughts on like how we're going to get to like net zero with carbon emissions, and like what kind of ideas students have brought forward through their assignments that you really liked and think might be solutions for the future.
Well, I found with that assignment, the problem with university is it's so driven on, you know, marks, marks, marks. I think a lot of, and this is what Graham Smith was always about. He was always about think, and less about marks, 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 but the institution doesn't love that so much. But a lot of the stuff that the students put forth, it was really not very creative. And I found that kind of distressing. Like there were some people who came up with some, you know, innovative things, and you could tell that it was an area they were interested in, and they, you know, came up with different things. Most people focused on the obvious, you know, carbon trading and, you know, think global, act local. And, you know, there was a few people who wrote about the importance of, you know, family farms and smaller scale farming in terms of reducing carbon output, which I thought was interesting, but it was pretty traditional and pretty, you know, mainstream, right? So and I think like, that's what everyone's taught them. So they just think, I want to hear that. So they tell it back to me.
Well, that's always a interesting paradox with just like university, obviously, because like you really want to develop those skills of like independent thought and really critical thinking. So you should be studying things that you're interested in, because you'll definitely, that'll manifest a lot more than if you're just really marks driven and like, okay, I want to go on to the next level. I need this in this course, whatever. No, that's a very interesting point.
Even like writing that assignment, like that hit home for me. Like it was just something that I would have never done research in. And then as I was learning more about the problem and learning about these different solutions, it was just super interesting. I think one of the things that I saw was kind of integrating more sustainable kind of technology. So integrating like a Nest home. I think in Vancouver, they use windows that are more sealed tight so that it's better for the air in your home and like keeping it warm and stuff, so you're not using as much energy. So that was just one really cool thing that I enjoyed learning from your class.
Yeah. I find assignments like that tend to have more impact after they're done. Like it's just something that you do because you have to do it, right? And it's an area you might not have looked into, but then it kind of plants a seed in your head that then, like you guys, right, you take it off and you've gone and done great things with it. So yeah.
And without getting like too like controversial, but like, what are your thoughts on like how the government, like, are some of the new initiatives that the government of Canada is putting forth to like combat climate change? So whether that's like the 2020 plastics ban, or 2021 rather, and like the carbon tax programs that they have in place. Like, have you like found any political leaders that you found interesting with like cool, innovative ideas that you think have a lot more potential? Or what are even just your thoughts on like the current things that they're implementing?
We just need to move to Scandinavia, because that's where all the like the smart leaders are, I think, because they've kind of taken a, you know, it's very more socialist to begin with, right? But as opposed to worrying about how much stuff costs, they're thinking more about what's going to cost if we don't do something. So, you know, greater investments in everything, you know, from wind to transport to tax. And I think for Canada, obviously a carbon tax is a no-brainer, and it did a lot of good really fast. And it was kind of disheartening that Doug Ford canceled it. But I think I kind of find the little victories and the little things, like the fact that we're going to get the United States back on board is really important as well. So I think, you know, at this point, it's like little things I think are more heartening to me, because we're so focused on COVID all the time, right? So like 2020 was just barely the warmest year on record. Only December threw it off, right? But nobody talked about that, or the fact that there were 30 hurricanes in the Atlantic, right? All that stuff. So I think we almost have to reset. But I was heartened to know that, you know, when dead of lockdown, like the climate crisis, basically, you know, the carbon was just gone, right? Like we can do it if we have to. And I think that was kind of uplifting in a time of dread.
Yeah, no, definitely, like, exactly what you said, like, humans can really pull together and react when, like, presented with, like, an immediate external threat, and I think, like, that's when kind of borders dissolve and we really come together to, like, solve something. It's interesting that, like, we can do it quickly despite having, like, billions of people on the planet. I guess the question that I would have, like, going back to kind of your schooling and stuff like that too, and just going on those assignments, like, have you had any, like, students that have come through that have, like, what are some of the cool innovative things that you've seen from students over the years, let's say, or even just in your research that you can share on those topics?
What have I seen? Like, I only have a handful of students. Like, with online learning, you don't get to meet people the same way, which I find is really hard. But, you know, I've had a bunch of students that I went to school with who are, like, faculty, you know, across Canada, and some of them are at different countries, and they're doing a lot of work in things, you know, related to, you know, hot oceans areas and the effect that climate has on, you know, sea turtles and that kind of thing. So the joys of academia is it's often really obscure stuff that most people in, like, the regular world don't care about. But a lot of people I know went to Duke, and they've been doing a lot of work with sea turtles. A lot of other people are working with erosion in the Himalayas related to, you know, changing monsoon patterns and that sort of thing. So the people I know that are doing great things are doing the silent work, you know, that people don't tend to talk about, but they're the things that make impacts in people's lives in, you know, mountainous areas in India or Nepal or even in British Columbia, that kind of thing.
I guess kind of even, like, going more now into, like, the academia part, how did you kind of get involved in what this interest of geography in the first place? Was this something from, like, a young age, or did you kind of learn throughout your own undergrad and stuff? Like, how did you get into everything?
Yeah, I still am. I'm an only child, and I grew up in the country, so I was always outside, and because there was nothing to do in the country, I was a girl guide and a 4-H, so I've always done environmental things from a young age, and then I got to high school and had a phenomenal teacher that got me interested in it, and I enjoyed, like, the physical geography and the weather and the issues, and then so that's what I took at Laurier. I did my degree in geography at Laurier, and then went on to do a master's in environmental impact assessment. But then I got there and I realized I liked the rural side a lot more. So that's where I ended up doing the impact of, you know, geography on our health is where I ended up with. So,
yeah, if you want to talk a little bit about that, like the geography of our health and even just more like, or like, I don't know, like we...
like some of your research that you got into with your master's and stuff.
Yeah. Oh, so I did basically a lot of work related to community sustainability in rural areas. So my master's was more about all aspects of living in a rural area, like everything from the environmental to the social to the political components that make communities sustainable or not sustainable. And then I compared, like, an area close to London and one that was slightly further afield to sort of look at the difference of peri-urbanism on how people act in the countryside. And then from there, I took out the healthcare component, so the more social part, which then I did for my PhD, where I actually did historical geography and I rebuilt the healthcare system from the time of initial settlement to then was like 2003 to sort of understand why in rural areas did people freak out when the government wanted to close their hospitals, but in Toronto and large urban areas, they didn't, right? So it was a lot about the sort of spatial patterns of, you know, health and access to healthcare and equity. And then obviously there's the environmental health component that probably is interesting related to climate or weather or, you know, pollution and chemicals and all that kind of thing. So
if you
were to talk about that for an hour or two.
I guess maybe some more like forward looking stuff now, or like maybe it wouldn't have been as much of a factor now that I think is something like social media and like this internet age and the information age and how that's like played a very large role now. If you were to kind of like rewrite that paper, maybe not even focusing as much on healthcare, but more on like the environmental side, with like so much more polarization now that we're seeing with social media, where you can kind of get in your silos and just keep getting fed information that like supports your bias. Like, how does that kind of like come together with like your previous thoughts and papers that you would have done? Like, if you were to rewrite those today and like try to look at some of those factors, like where would you see those things having an impact on?
Or do you think there wouldn't be like as many changes? Do you think it would be like very similar?
No, I know what I think it would be similar. Like, I mean, I think really social media, having, you know, grown up through it, like from when there wasn't any to where there is any, like, it's basically just changed from, you know, news outlets and news sources and magazines and different kinds of media that is something that's easy to access, which I think is great. But I think for me and my research, if I were to sort of retool it, I would think about the, you know, the sort of polarization of rural and urban, right? Like when you just look at any election, you know, Alberta is always blue and the rural areas are always blue and the cities are red, you know, whether you're in the States or in Canada, right? So rural is really, from my experience, it's a culture. It's not just people, right? So I'm probably saying right too many times. When you're on Zoom, you hear ums and rights a lot. So this whole idea that you have people who think completely different from other people, and you know, rural areas take up so much of our land and they're so important for, you know, carbon capture and, you know, sustainable farming and all of those things, but they're managed by people who don't necessarily believe that it's a problem. So there's that sort of polarization there as well. So I think that would be something, if I could go back and retool it and focus on that, it would be a lot about the sort of cultural polarization. And I don't think I would have done it as a PhD student just because it's probably too controversial. You need to sort of be established to sort of take on the establishment, right?
Yeah, I know. And that's very interesting that you say that too. And do you think like there's really like, obviously it's hard to put like an exact like line in the sand of where you would kind of say this has now gone from rural to more urban, like as we have like more immigrants coming to Canada, let's say, we're going to start seeing population growth, we're going to have more of these urbanization of once rural communities and start seeing some shifts there. And what I meant by more social media is like, do you think it's a tool that can help like smooth those transitions, because you're going to have more, you have the potential to be exposed to more ideas, and it kind of helps with that transition? Or you think it'll be more of like a negative in the transition, where people who are in kind of maybe experiencing gentrification or a lot of these rural communities that don't want this to happen, do you think with social media it might actually help, it'll create more controversy because they're always going to be fed information to kind of resist a lot of these changes that they're experiencing?
Yeah, I think that's the one downside of social media is, and I mean, my feed's probably just as bad and I'm just as guilty as, is you follow the stuff that you're interested in and you believe in, right? So I think it sort of boxes down the number of options that are available for people to get information if they're not of the mind to think about both sides, right? Not everyone like me goes actively looking for a Bjorn Lomborg book to like see what's going on. I think it would be a really good idea if somehow we could break that cycle of, you know, algorithms feeding you more of the same that you've already seen that you like, because it's all that whole idea of the psychology of getting information. And not to say that old-fashioned traditional media was exactly the same. It fed more of the same, it just did it in a newspaper format. But I think you have to balance that with the rapid availability of information and able to share information. And like, I've learned so much from Twitter about, you know, events and, you know, I have my pocket app and I drop articles in like crazy, because I like to use those for my classes, because I think what's happening in social media and in the media is really a good tool to study things from, like what are people doing, what's working, what's not working, and learn about things you never would ever hear about in a regular mainstream media source.
Sure. Yeah, I guess to even keep kind of going down that little pathway there, are there any other resources or recommendations for information where students or other people, just like our listeners, could learn more about specific topics in your field of research?
And like, how do you, like, what's kind of the strategy that you apply? I'm sure like you said, you'd like to play devil's advocate and get exposure to both. Like, mm-hmm. How do you know, like, when you've kind of gone too far down one side versus the other? Like, what kind of tools do you use to pull yourself back and like kind of re-examine where you're approaching, like
balance back out again?
Yeah, I think that's sort of one of the nice things about having, you know, been in school for 10 years is that, you know, doing a PhD sort of teaches you to look at information critically and balance that, and having had the influence of, you know, Dr. Smith to sort of say, look at the other side and understand where people came from. At the time, I thought he was crazy, but as I've gotten older, I realize that's a really smart thing to do. And I think in classes, students, you know, learn the most when you sort of challenge them to think differently. And I realize I'm going on a tangent from your original question, but I think, you know, if you can follow, you know, one of my favorite things, I'll put a plug out there, is the NASA Earth Observatory. They have a daily, I just bought the daily book that was published just in November. So it's all sorts of great pictures taken from space, any kind of different remote sensing, so you can see changes over time, and you see things that are happening in the world that you don't normally see, and it always comes with a story. So the daily always gives you an Earth view with a scientific story that goes with it. And I think that's a really good way to keep track. So I read that religiously every day along with the word of the day. And I think that's a, NASA is a really great source for information that, you know, because it's scientific, but it also provides, they have some really good writers and they have a really good social media strategy that I find is really fun.
Cool. And yeah, just to kind of, I guess, part 1A of that question, what are, beyond like NASA, like, is there any like audiobooks or like, I mean, you mentioned a few already, but like, where do you kind of source this stuff and where do you recommend like students to kind of like, as they're going through their learning to kind of like, how do you initially teach them to learn some of these skills that if they can't get a, you know, a 10-year PhD, where do you start at like year one? And like, how do you kind of like guide them in that sense?
One of my favorite assignments always was a media study where I got students to follow the news for a semester and sort of find articles in an area of environment or of interest so that they're actively looking for issues. And then, you know, some of them might pick climate change and some of them might pick, you know, pollution, or they might pick water. What they pick all sorts of things. And basically they follow it in the media and they are actively asked to go out and get out of their bubble and, like, you know, read beyond what you would normally read in your regular feed and just find different things. And then once you get to sort of the third month of the semester, to take all of your information and then analyze it critically to see, you know, who's saying what, are certain media outlets saying different things. If they're talking about published scientific literature, go back to the original journal and see how they've taken the message from what was published, you know, for the scientific community, for the lay community, because sometimes that happens, and then get them to critically analyze what they read. You know, it used to be where, how much space did it actually take up in the news, that kind of thing. There's all those different aspects of just something that it's really simple and they love it. They don't have to buy a textbook. You just like grab the media, it's there. You don't have to go to the library. They always love that. So I think if you can make learning and thinking easier, especially now when everybody's so busy, I think that's a really good approach.
Yeah, awesome. even for us, when we're making content, a lot of it comes from a lot of the news that's coming out, and we're wanting to share all these new solutions or different problems that are emerging, because there's nowhere else that we're going to get it necessarily.
And honestly, like, to answer your 1A question, like, that's where I get everything, is I am an avid, you know, voracious reader of news and information. Like, I've always been that way, and I find that, you know, even if it's something that you laugh at or you think this makes no sense, you can always go back to the original source, learn more about it. You know, it takes you into places you might not normally think of. And I've found, like, December got to be really busy at school and I stopped reading the news and I really felt lost. And then when I would read the news, I would think, oh wow, look at what I've missed, right? It's, you do miss a lot in only about 2 weeks. So I think, you know, the media and people and how people interact and what we write about ourselves is the, you know, the greatest toolbox for learning about environment and climate.
Yeah, no, and that's a great point that you said too. Like, everything just seems like it's so fast paced, like the volume and velocity of information that we're getting, to be able to like decipher it, you are limited in your time. So you have to kind of either compensate with like how deep you get that information. So mm-hmm. if you're getting full blown articles, really reading in depth on something, or you go a mile wide but an inch deep and you're really like exposed to a lot of topics but never really the full extreme. So it's kind of always, you're having that trade-off to deal with.
And it's overwhelming too. So I like that you say pick a specific area that you're interested in, whether it's just climate change, because then it helps you to kind of go through certain things but not necessarily be so overwhelmed with everything.
Yeah, and like, because I'm not a full-time academic, most academics, you know, they read all the latest journal articles, and mm-hmm. I don't have time for that. So I like to, you know, get the summaries of what comes from my favorite journal, and then I read the ones I'm interested in. But I find if you can keep up with what's going on in the world, that's just about as important, right, for what I'm doing, because I'm more on the teaching side and less on the research side. I think knowing what's going on is, you know, really important to be an informed citizen, and you can make contributions without leaving your house, right? We found that out a lot in the last 6 months.
Yeah, so clearly you have like a huge interest like in education, like kind of building on that, like and even the research side. Do you think that that's something you might pursue like later in your life, like once you're, I mean, you have a full other career as well too, like you're very busy, but like where do you kind of see yourself going, and like specifically why, like what do you like the most, like kind of two questions here, and then also like what do you like the most about teaching, like what's been the most rewarding, by like why did you gravitate towards that rather than like research, and do you think that will shift over time?
Yeah, I don't know. Like initially my goal as, you know, when you're in university, you know what you want to do with your life. I was going to be a high school teacher. And when I got into teacher college, there were no jobs. So I decided to go do a master's degree and they'd pay me instead. And then I found when I was there, you can TA and you can teach just as well, right? And it was even higher order thinking and, you know, more liberty of the things you covered. So I found that was nice as opposed to, you know, following Doug Ford's curriculum. You could be a little more creative in what you did. And so I tried to emulate all the things about different professors I had over the years that I liked and tried to not do the things that the ones I didn't like. And that's been fun. So, and I just like enjoy young people because they're so full of energy and ideas. And, you know, traditionally the establishment says sit down until you're older. But I mean, really, we just need the older people to get out of the way and you guys need to take over. So I've often, all my colleagues at work, you know, they call me Dr. Google because that's what they do. And they say that I should not be working in the hospital. I'm wasted, but they're just being kind. So I find I can do my part and, you know, in my job, which I love because I get to work with healthcare and help people that way. But then I also get to do the teaching side, which is fun. And, you know, if it ever came to a point where they would say, okay, here, Denise, you can teach full time and just do that, I think I would consider that because it's probably less busy than the lifestyle I've created for myself working full time teaching also. But it's fun. It's like some people pay lots of money to have horses and instead my hobby pays me. So.
No, that's super awesome. And I think, I guess even in a question, like more a little bit on the topic of just COVID, like what has been like the online experience like from like a professor's perspective? Obviously like my sister's a university student, school, she can talk about her experience, I'm sure. But what's that experience been like for you? And I guess.
And even for work, like how have things been as well?
Oh, like. That like school was stupid. Like I was, you know, we're almost done like in March, right? So all of a sudden you had to do this 180 pivot to like, let's do everything online. And I was working on a community engaged learning course at the time. So that course was really about students doing projects in environmental health promotion. So we just basically, they finished that. But this last semester I taught a class in mandatory health policy for third year students at Western, and there were 320 of them. Wow. And it was asynchronous, and it was the craziest time I've ever had because it was so busy. Like I could not fathom how busy it was, and everybody's stressed out. The students are stressed out. They take it out on you, but you can't take it personally because you're stressed out, and they, you know, it was it just wasn't cool, but we managed to muddle through. And I basically changed what I would normally do in a regular class. I would, you know, we switched to case study learning instead of textbooks, which they liked. I have a 23-year-old daughter and a 15-year-old daughter, and they said, Mom, you got to do vlogs. Vlogs are cool. So for the first 6 weeks of term, I made a vlog every week that kind of showed what it was like for me at work and how the policy stuff we were talking about in class was, you know, falling out at work. But then life got too busy and I had to stop. But I think it was just really important to engage, and a lot of students have since written and said thank you for not being like everyone else who just posted a PowerPoint and said figure it out for yourself, which is too bad because they're getting paid to do that and I'm doing this part-time. But so it was challenging, it was also rewarding, and I learned a lot about myself and about other people. Yeah, and then work has been busy because I work in the hospital. So, you know, pandemic reports, building new stuff, lots of work. You know, we also had to work from home because of the PPE shortage at the beginning. So we all had to transition to, you know, not being allowed to work at home ever to guess what, go home and figure this out. So you miss the adult interaction when you're at home all the time. The dog and the family's nice, but
too much of it's a little overwhelming. Same with our dog. He's always barking.
Yeah, he's literally just, we had to put ourselves on mute right now just because he was literally like, he has like an ear infection. He's like scratching and like, he's good now, but.
Yeah, I think that's the fun part of everybody working at home is you get to realize everybody are real people, right? You know, the dog barks and the kids swear, and, you know, my kids would like waltz in the middle of a class and make faces, and the mailman would come and all hell breaks loose. But everybody has the same experience, right? And I think everyone's been really supportive. Like if anything else, it taught me about, you know, people are still people, and it's nice that, you know, taking time out of our normal life, even though it was forced, kind of brought people together in ways that we hadn't before. So that was nice.
And it's going to have like a long lasting impact going forward. I think even like to what you were just describing, what your daughter was saying about like having to like change the way that you would normally teach. And I think like that's, especially in the education is what I was focusing on there. I think like it's going to lead to a lot of long-term impact where there, it'll be more readily available for sure, but that model has to be like completely flipped over. Like I remember like taking some online courses like at Laurier, and like it was always like not like a running joke, but it's just kind of like it's a, you know, it's an online course, and you know, like it's a completely different learning experience than in classroom. Yeah. And I think now like those lines are going to have to get blurred a lot more, where the quality of education needs to be on par, whether online or in person. And it really just like, I think in one way it empowers like the potential of like reach and impact that you can have with your education. But it's just interesting that you're almost like using social media techniques to like teach, essentially, like when you're vlogging and you're doing a lot of it's so like, I find like that's so interesting, because even us, like we're really big advocates of TikTok. I don't know if you've like been on that at all, but it's kind of like we need to be very creative in how we like share our messages on certain topics that we're touching on, and we want to educate. So it's like we have the same goal as you. Obviously you're teaching a course, like we're just like, yeah, build a brand, but like very similar strategies we're both applying. Yeah
That's cool.
I guess kind of just to like wrap things up here, is there one kind of key takeaway that you want to share with our audience, whether that's like something from your research that you found that was really cool, or like a statistic, something that you think would just really resonate,
even like a story, like anything, so what you want to like tie off and leave with
whatever your intuition is, like.
don't overthink it.
Yeah.
Okay, if I'm not supposed to overthink it, I'll come with whatever came to my head. I would just totally sound like a total mid-40s loser and say never stop learning. Like honestly, I've been in university since 1992 in some form or another, and I think I love that, and I think you don't need to be in university to keep learning, and what you guys are doing is great because you're helping people to learn. And I think that is, you know, and love the world and love your planet, and everything else will fall in line, I hope.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this podcast. If you would like to learn more, visit us at www.last20.ca. Until next time, stay sustainable.